VOA, the science edition of Press Conference USA. Here is your host, Rick Pantaleo.
Welcome to the science edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. The Internet has become an invaluable resource for information and communication and is now an important part of many of our everyday lives. With just a few clicks, we can catch up on the latest news, get information previously only available to us in libraries, and communicate with each other via texting, email, and social media platforms. Sometimes we may forget about the many ways the Internet and related resources helps us day to day. Since many of us are familiar with the Internet of today, we're going to take a look and see what the Internet might be like in the near and distant future in the first half of our program. In our second segment, we'll examine the mysterious segments of cyberspace that no one really talks about. It's called the deep, dark, or black web. These are private encrypted sections of the Internet, separate from the regular Internet we normally access every day. My first guest is making a return appearance to Press Conference USA. She's futurist Amy Webb, the founder and CEO of Future Today Institute. It's a company that they say uses data-driven forecasting tools to provide corporations and other organizations with information on emerging science and technology trends. Amy Webb is also the author of several books, including her latest, The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. Amy Webb joins us today by telephone. Amy, you have written on your website and in your latest book that future historians will look back on this time as the turning point for media, information, and technology. What do you mean by that?
We are at a moment in time in which there's widespread convergence across all of the different devices and technologies that we use. And essentially what that means is that we're entering a sort of new era of computing. And that will definitely present opportunities for a lot of individuals. It will also increase the digital divide in some communities. And while it offers interesting new ways for everybody to connect, there are lots of governments around the world that will find it very difficult to shore up their security and make sure that the integrity of the systems that they use are in check.
Speaking of new devices, could you fill us in a little bit about some of these new electronic personal assistant technology that uses vocal interfaces? Right now we've got Apple Siri, Google Assistant, and Amazon Alexa. And where do you see this technology going?
Our data show that between now and the year 2022, more than half of the interactions that we have with computers will be with our voices. And to some extent, that's because for many of us, the majority of our interactions with computers happen over our smartphones. But in industrialized nations around the world, we are increasingly being confronted with digital assistants. They're not just in our phones and they're not just in Bluetooth speakers. There are lots of major home appliances that are coming to market in 2018 and 2019 that have digital assistants as part of their operating systems. So
this is the Internet of Things?
Yeah, well, so they connect through the Internet of Things, but I'm talking about sort of connected washing machines and refrigerators that you can talk to with your voice, but they also communicate with each other. So, for example, if you're in a different part of your house and want to know if your laundry is done, you'd be able to query the laundry machine. However, there are also some real safety features. So if you've put a pizza in the oven to heat up and the oven is caught on fire, your oven would communicate with the smart smoke detector in your home. And rather than alerting you, the smoke detector would override the oven and shut it down. So there's a lot of really interesting activity right now, us humans talking to machines, machines talking to each other, and what comes next is a lot of automation.
When you're talking about us talking to these devices directly and them communicating with each other, first thing comes to mind is security and privacy. Will this be an issue?
Yeah, security and privacy are always issues anytime you're dealing with connected devices. One of the really sort of startling, but I also thought kind of in an academic way, sort of interesting security vulnerabilities we've seen over the past couple of years was when something called the MeetEye botnet infected DVRs all around the United States. So this was malware that infected people's DVRs, which are connected to the Internet, which, again, you would probably have had no way of knowing that the malware was in the system, but it's that malware that was used to effectively shut down the internet. So we're going to start seeing probably more of these security vulnerabilities. Part of the reason for that is because the Internet of Things is really exploding and connected devices are everywhere. And unlike our computers, connected devices are intended to be very easy to use. You sort of plug and play. And therefore, we don't oftentimes think about firmware and security patches. The companies who make a lot of these devices, probably somebody within the organization is monitoring security, but I don't think they're doing a very good job of letting the everyday consumer know that there's a necessary security patch because of some kind of vulnerability that somebody discovered. And as a result, you know, we could see a lot of these devices that we use becoming weaponized now. Does that mean that the devices that we talk to, like Siri and Alexa, are equally vulnerable, or that somebody might hack your Amazon Echo and Echo Show? The bigger companies tend to have a bigger budget for security and oversight. So the likelihood of somebody missing something at Amazon is a lot lower than somebody at a smaller company who maybe just doesn't have the budget and the resources to constantly be very vigilant about their security. On the other hand, Amazon's a big, shiny target. That would be a high-priced hack. And so there's another piece of this, which is that there's something called zero-day exploits. 0 days are when, quite literally, the developers and the coders missed something, usually small. And once hackers figure it out, everybody has sort of like 0 days to make a fix. And I just want to clarify, Amazon is a target because they're a wildly successful company, not because I have some knowledge that they're vulnerable. It's nothing like that. They're right. Just a very, very big, successful company. And they are also part of the backbone of the internet. So Amazon, in addition to delivering your packages, also delivers you quite a bit of the digital content that you consume via something called Amazon Web Services. So this is sort of part of that invisible layer of the internet that we don't see, but we come into contact with every day. So a lot of content providers, the digital infrastructure of companies, and a lot of this stuff lives on Amazon Web Services. That's a big part of the internet. And it's not just for storage. So Amazon, Microsoft with its Azure product, so that's their cloud product. Google has its own cloud-based services product. So does IBM. All of these companies are pushing pretty headstrong into artificial intelligence. And one of the things that they've done is made their tools freely available or available at a, you know, relatively limited cost as long as you're using their cloud services. So, for example, Amazon has just released a smart camera developer's kit where the camera itself, and this is intended to be sort of a home security system, I believe, but the camera itself has AI software on board. So you could potentially do some really interesting things with that software. There are a few police departments around the country in the United States that are using one of Amazon's recognition APIs. It's called Recognition, which allows them to upload or access mugshots or photos from a website. And then if they pull somebody over or they've got security footage or whatever, if they're trying to find somebody who they think has perpetrated a crime, this image recognition tool that's part of Amazon Web Services now is something that they can deploy to figure out who the potential criminal is. And law enforcement agencies have been using this system around the U.S. So it's sort of a brave new world for AI and for the cloud and connected devices. However, that makes it ever more important for us to be very deliberate in sharing our information and making sure that we understand the security and privacy implications.
Can you tell us about where we're going as far as the direction of the physical internet itself?
Previously, the internet was a space that was open and continually growing and expanding. The more devices that got connected, the more sort of space that it took up and the more people got to use it. What's happened is that the idyllic utopian idea of a worldwide web in which information wanted to be free and democracy flourished didn't quite pan out once we realized that there were trolls and bad actors and maybe governments who wanted to cause trouble for others. So what's happened is some countries around the world have started to enforce different types of legislation and rules, which would make it illegal, or at the very least would mean the infraction of a rule, to post certain kinds of content on the internet. So, for example, in Canada, it is currently illegal for Google in its search results to list any pirated products, so fake Louis Vuitton handbags or something. If it's found out that somebody was searching to buy a fake Louis Vuitton handbag and one showed up in search results, technically Google is subject to a pretty hefty fine. In Germany, there's been ongoing debate over a pretty serious new rule that would make it a crime for anybody to post hate speech on social networks. And again, for any instance of that, there would be potentially $50 million per instance in fines. The challenge is that there's no global standard with regards to rules. And so what we're starting to see is that depending where geographically you are when you're accessing the internet, the rules that must be followed by third parties are different, effectively creating, rather than just one internet, a splintered internet or a series of splinternets. Nobody is asking for this. Nobody out there, including myself, wants splinternets. It would make it incredibly difficult to do business. It would make it much easier for the spread of misinformation. It would just be bad all around. Unfortunately, we may be heading very quickly into a series of splinternets, sort of as an inevitability, and that is because a lot of the big technology companies and social media providers and platforms haven't done a very good job thinking through the implications of allowing bots to post whatever they want and people to spread misinformation and to, in many other ways, break the local laws of various countries. So this is a serious problem and one that's only going to get worse as the year wears on. Now, some people, you know, and these are more tech-savvy folks, are using alternate solutions. So there are peer-to-peer networks popping up, ways for you to circumvent the traditional internet and instead access through virtual personal networks or private networks, VPNs, or other peer-to-peer sharing services to send content back and forth. There was, for a very short time, something called Project Maelstrom, which was started by the founders of BitTorrent. Now, that BitTorrent had kind of a shakeup last year, and so the project got put to the side. But essentially, the idea of it was that it would be sort of a secondary internet, especially in places where political dissidents, people trying to usher in democracy in places where there are autocratic rulers or people who are oppressed and there is no freedom of the press. The idea would be that this would be a place for them to share content.
Finally, let's get back to devices again. You had written that 2018 will mark the beginning of the end of smartphones in the world's largest economies. Now, how do you see this happening now? And
sure.
what will replace the consumers' beloved smartphones?
So what started to happen is in wealthy industrialized nations, the sales of smartphones have already started to plateau. And device manufacturers are working very hard to make sure that everybody buys a new phone every 18 to 24 months. However, these phones are getting more and more expensive, and I think we're starting to see some consumer backlash. People don't want to keep having to purchase those phones every couple years. Simultaneously, what's happening is that we're finally starting to see augmented reality and smart glasses that are probably going to be coming to market in a meaningful way over the next couple of years. And so if you think of smart glasses as an alternative to smartphones, which in many cases they will be, essentially what that means is that the folks who are early adopters of smartphones will become early adopters of smart glasses, and the new smart glasses that are going to be coming to market don't require a phone. So the glasses, probably in combination with a wristband, will supplant the need for a smartphone going forward. And I'm not saying that 10 years from now there won't be smartphones anywhere. I would say that the data show that this year is probably the beginning of what will be a gradual but eventual tapering off.
Amy Webb, I want to thank you so much for taking time again to join us for our conversation today.
Sure thing.
That was Amy Webb, the founder and CEO of the science and technology forecasting company, the Future Today Institute.
She is also the author of several books, including her latest, The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. You're listening to the Science Edition of Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo, reminding you that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow and connect with us on Twitter or Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. And you can also send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Let's return to today's program. In this segment, we'll explore the mysterious and little-known portions of the Internet that have been called the deep, dark, or black web. Some refer to these areas of the Internet as the secret underground of cyberspace. The deep, dark, or black web are quite private and secured with encryption to prevent unauthorized access. Because of this, you can't use your regular Internet Explorer or Google Chrome browsers to access it. Instead, you must use specialized software, computer configurations, or have special authorization to gain entry. While some of those who visit websites that are a part of the deep, dark, or black web do so simply because of the privacy it offers, others, however, may use it to conduct somewhat nefarious business such as selling or buying drugs or stolen personal data and child pornography. Dan Patterson, a senior writer at Tech Republic, an online publication aimed at information technology professionals. He joins us by Skype today to tell us what the deep, dark, or black web is and what it's not. Dan, first of all, tell us, just what is the deep, dark, or black web?
This is a topic that's often confused by the jargon that's used, the dark web, the dark net, the black web, the onion web. All of these refer to a network exactly like the internet that we use today, with one exception. To access these sites, you need a particular browser that can decrypt encrypted websites. So often this browser is a fork or a split of the Firefox browser called Tor. Although there are a number of these browsers, they all do the same thing, and that's that they access websites that often have funny, weird, or changeable URLs with the .onion extension. This means that the content of that website is encrypted to the general public and can only be decrypted using this special web browser.
So these websites are basically just encrypted websites that you often see also on the regular internet.
That's exactly right. The reason the dark web or the dark net, black web, onion web, it has such a mystique is because the content of these websites is often, although not always, illicit. You can find illegal drug or illegal human trafficking and other illicit behaviors, particularly exfiltrated data. This means data from breaches like Equifax or Yahoo that affect people all over the world. This information is bought and sold on marketplaces that can at times resemble, at least from an ease of use standpoint, a regular e-commerce site like Amazon.com. There are legitimate uses for the dark web, and some of those uses are for journalists and activists, cryptologists, law enforcement organizations. These are legitimate uses for the dark web. And of course, encryption itself is a commonly used technology that we use every day to protect our communication, our bank account information, and other information that wants or needs to be private.
We've talked about three terms: dark, deep, black web. You mentioned onion network as well. What are the differences between the different nets? I mean, does one do something the other doesn't?
I'm glad you brought that up, Rick, because there is one differentiator here, and that is the deep web. That is a term that is often misused and mixed up with the dark web. The deep web is the regular internet you use every day, but is not indexed by search engines like Google or Bing. This is your office intranet. It could be your banking sites. It could be your email. Regular websites that don't require an additional browser or other technologies that are simply not accessed by the general public. The dark web, on the other hand, is that network of encrypted websites that we spoke about a moment ago.
You talked about the Tor browser. It's a browser. And you say it's an offshoot from Mozilla's Firefox?
That's correct. And again, the Tor browser is a legitimate, above board, and pretty well accepted in the security community web browser. Tor is simply used to access encrypted websites, and its own traffic is obscured or obfuscated. This doesn't mean it's entirely safe from prying eyes of your ISP or law enforcement. The way Tor works is, and the reason it's called the Onion browser, is that it pings your IP address and kind of routes that around the world in layers so that it's harder to trace activity back to your computer.
As far as accessing websites on the dark web, deep web, for the regular internet, we use things like search engines like Google and Yahoo. Does the dark net have a similar navigation software?
Well, yes and no. And I would suspect that some of the mystique of the dark web comes from weird URLs that often shift around, and you can find pretty unusual content there. I would never advocate visiting the dark web without properly preparing your computer and without the disclaimer that much of the content on the dark web is not legal, and you should make sure that you have a good understanding of technology before engaging with the dark web or encrypted web browsers. Without a technical understanding, it's pretty easy to make a simple mistake. I think that the dark web has not a discoverability problem because many of the sites rely on staying under the radar, but because there's so much illicit activity on the dark web, websites often go up and they come down as law enforcement raids different servers, or as servers realize, as web hosting companies realize that they're hosting illicit traffic, they'll often kick people off of the web. Having said that, there are dark web discoverability tools. One of the most famous is called HiddenWiki, and its URL is hidden. You often have to do a ClearNet, a regular web search, to find the HiddenWiki URL. And you can use that as a jumping off point. There are other companies, Terbium Labs is one, that will create dark web monitoring tools for regular people, for companies, whether they're SMBs or enterprise companies, to help people find information when it's been exfiltrated from hacks and data leaks. Often this stuff does turn up on the dark web, and you need a reputable company to find and to monitor this activity.
I'm quite curious, Dan. You're talking about websites, servers going up, coming down. How do people who regularly use the dark net navigate? How do they get around knowing that this could happen?
Well, you often navigate it much like you would in the internet, say, 20 years ago, or through word of mouth. There are forums, there are chat groups, and many of these are on the ClearNet. Reddit has kind of a weird reputation for hosting some sketchy content from time to time, but there are some fantastic, legitimate conversations that happen there as well, and often these conversations will lead to a dark web or darknet link.
How safe is the darknet, deepnet, as far as accessing it? Any dangers from like viruses or malware?
Yes, absolutely. You can access the dark web safely and securely, but you should always exercise caution. Some websites, just like a Clear website, can inject malware onto your computer, but there is also the danger of stumbling across illicit activity, illegal drugs. There are certainly underage pornography and activities that we would generally, if not find illegal, incredibly offensive or distasteful, but oftentimes illegal as well.
That was going to be my next question to you, is if the dark web was illegal and logging on to a dark website could result in a visit by the local law enforcement.
Well, it's very important to make this distinction here. The dark web is not, and nor should ever be, illegal itself, because the technologies that power what we call the dark web are technologies like encryption that we rely on every day, allowing backdoors into encrypted systems. Every single expert, no matter what spectrum of the political reality you live in, is on, real experts will tell you that it's a very bad idea to create keys and backdoors to encryption. This is really important stuff. Encryption, as a matter of fact, by the United States, is guaranteed as a fundamental human right. Mm-hmm. Why? Because security and privacy of mind and security and privacy of communication are inherent with security and privacy in the United States, what we call our First Amendment rights, and throughout the rest of the world, the right to speak and the right to express yourself. So allowing keys and backdoors into encryption not only undermines that on an existential and larger level, it also undermines the tools we use to lock pretty important stuff like our regular email, our bank accounts.
Can you tell me what's the Silk Road and its role in developing the deep dark web?
Well, there was no role in the Silk Road in developing the dark web. The Silk Road was an early e-commerce site that sold things like drugs and certainly practiced human trafficking and other illegal activity. The Silk Road was a website. It was not an idea or a technology like encryption is. Mm-hmm. The dark web existed long before the Silk Road. And although this has been very well documented by a number of reporters, we did a great job covering it at CNET, ZDNet, and Tech Republic. The Silk Road was as much of an internet drama that unfolded in real time as it was a website. But it is no more the internet than Google is the internet. Google is a product and a technology, but it's not the internet, nor is the Silk Road the dark web.
Does the website still exist?
No, the Silk Road was taken down many years ago.
How much of the total internet can be considered dark, deep, or black?
Very, very, very small. It is estimated that there are only at any given time, again, these are statistics provided to me by Terbium Lab, that there are only 50 to 100,000 sites live at any given time. Of course, this changes as the market changes and as more people come on. There certainly will be more websites, but the more and more illegal activity, the more law enforcement activity as well. It's not as though the FBI and other law enforcement agencies, UNODC is the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime, they're certainly aware of activity that happens in the dark web and have a very large presence there.
Someone just getting into the deep dark web, how can they protect themselves, keep themselves safe while visiting sites on the deep dark web?
Well, there are a number of ways to approach this question. The first is, if you have no business on the dark web yourself, you don't need to be there. What you need to be aware of, though, is that your data is likely on the dark web. And that means if you run a business or are a CISO in charge of the information of one person to 100 million people, when a cyber attack happens, that information that is leaked, stolen, exfiltrated from a company, that's your information, and that often ends up on the dark web. That's why monitoring services exist. These are often built into your credit card or your credit report. These are services that will look at not just the clear net, but the dark web as well. So you need to be aware of the dark web, no matter who you are. But if you don't have business on the dark web, don't go on the dark web. It is an interesting place, but it's also a place that requires some technical proficiency before you start exploring. And mistakes in your technical proficiencies can either A, prevent you from going to the places or the sites that you want to go, or B, expose your IP address and a lot of other information to a website owner or to law enforcement officials. So the first thing I would do is educate yourself, mm-hmm. inform yourself, spend a lot of time reading and read from different sources and try to read from legitimate sources that have kind of verified or at least done the research for you. Then you want to experiment using the Tor web browser. And again, I encourage you to read the information on the website before just jumping in. Again, if you have no business on the dark web, don't go on the dark web.
Thank you very much for joining us today. I really appreciate your insight and your information.
Rick, I appreciate being here. Thank you very much for having me.
That was Dan Patterson, a senior writer at Tech Republic, an online publication aimed at information technology professionals. He joined us today by Skype. And that's all the time we have on this edition of Press Conference USA. I want to thank you so much for listening. I'd also like to thank my guests for joining me today, as well as our studio technicians, Rob McLean and Zubier El Tayeb. This is Rick Pantaleo, reminding you to join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.